Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
The last several weeks have featured a number of dramatic developments surrounding the war that started after Russia's invasion of Ukraine on February the 24th. We have seen the stunning multi-pronged counteroffensive by the Ukrainians, in which they've taken back more territory in a month than Russia took in the last 6 months. Russia has been forced to retreat, not only on the battlefield, but from the assertions that their so-called special military operation would be quick and efficient as it mobilizes to conscript additional troops. And President Putin has orchestrated a series of sham referenda and annexations of four Ukrainian regions, even as its political and rhetorical allies such as China and India are starting to indicate perhaps some level of concern. And now, of course, the specter of potential Russian use of a nuclear weapon has been raised again. And meanwhile, the West, led by the United States, has remained united, but the economic and therefore political price is mounting. And winter is coming with all of the implications that that has for both the battlefield and keeping Europe warm this winter. So here today to talk with me about where we are and where this war may be heading, I'm joined by two expert colleagues, both of whom are veterans of this program. Michelle Flournoy is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the highest ranking woman in the history of the Department of Defense. She served in the Obama administration under Secretaries Robert Gates and Leon Panetta. She co-founded with Kirk Campbell the bipartisan national security policy think tank, the Center for a New American Security. And today she is the managing partner of Teneo's strategic partner firm West Exec Advisors, which she co-founded in 2017 with the current Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, and two other partners. Andrea Kendall Taylor. She is a fan favorite of this program. She is a senior advisor to West Exec Advisors and a senior fellow and the director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. She's an adjunct professor at Georgetown's School of Foreign Service. And she led the United States' intel community's strategic analysis of Russia when she served as the Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And before that, as a senior analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency. So thank you both for joining today. There's a lot to cover here, so I want to jump right into it. Michelle, maybe let's start with you. You know, I'd love to hear your assessment of where we are, you know, sort of right now, the big picture, the war, the situation with the Putin-led government, and the solidarity, strength, and staying power of the Western response and support for Ukraine. How do you see things now?
First of all, it's great to be back with you, Kevin, and to share the stage with Andrea. You know, if we dial the clock back to the beginning of this year, you know, I think we were still thinking about a vision of Europe that really emerged after the end of the Cold War, which was a Europe whole, free, and at peace. And Putin's invasion in February really shattered that reality and created a new one. And, you know, he was clearly motivated by trying to reestablish Russia as a great power with a sphere of influence, kind of recapturing Russian influence and domination of many of the states of the former Soviet Union. That's been his legacy issue for quite some time. But, you know, I think the invasion of Ukraine certainly hasn't gone the way he expected militarily, and even in terms of how it's affected Russia's economy and international standing. I think the impacts on Europe are quite profound and lasting. This has really changed the trajectory of Europe. We see, ironically, a much more cohesive and unified Europe in the face of Russian aggression. A NATO that has come together, is increasing defense spending, a Europe that is now accelerating its energy pivot away from dependency on Russian sources, and unfortunately some impacts on European politics in terms of the economic pressures, inflation, in some cases heading towards recession, that's begotten some reemergence of more extreme right nationalist politics. You've also had profound ripple effects beyond Europe. Obviously, this has contributed to inflation that we're all experiencing, food insecurity. I serve on the board of CARE. We're seeing a rolling back of a lot of the progress that we've made against hunger in recent years because of this crisis. And of course, as I mentioned, the acceleration of the energy transition. So very profound impacts. I don't think Putin anticipated many of these impacts. It's certainly hurting Russia in the long term, not helping it, but this is far from over. So let me stop there.
Yeah, so Andrea, I want to bring you into the conversation here and focus a little bit on what you're seeing on the battlefield itself, because obviously that has huge implications for everything that Michelle was just talking about. Russia in recent days has been in retreat again, retreating from the strategically important city of Lyman in Donetsk just one day after the annexation was essentially announced. How would you characterize the status of the battlefield right now? What are you seeing there?
Well, as you said, I mean, I think it's clear or we can easily say that momentum is on Ukraine's side. And rewinding just a little bit, just to say a couple of words about this very successful counteroffensive in Kharkiv, right? That was a major success, probably the most significant success the Ukrainians have had since they successfully defended Kiev. It was something that we were all waiting for. You know, Zelensky had talked a lot about wanting to demonstrate to the West and Western backers that Ukraine was capable of retaking territory. So we were all waiting for, you know, weeks, if not months, for a counteroffensive, most likely in the south. The Russians then had to redeploy forces down south. That created vulnerabilities that the Ukrainians were able to exploit. So that has created this wave of momentum that I think that they've continued to effectively ride. It set them up. I mean, what they took in Kharkiv was important, not just psychologically, but because it disrupted supply lines and other things. And so I think they continue to reap the benefits of that successful counteroffensive in the north. So that has continued. And as you said, they're also having progress in the south. And that has been, I think their approach has been a steady degradation of Russian forces there. I think the thing that's different about Lyman and the south is that the Ukrainians did not have the element of surprise. These are areas where they've been slugging it out for some time. We also know that in contrast to Kharkiv, some of Russia's best, most effective fighters are down south. And the fact that the Ukrainians continue to have success there, I think speaks volume of the trajectory and the momentum that they have. And it really underscores that Russian forces are degraded. I think what the Ukrainians are thinking at this point is they likely see a window of time before the effects of mobilization kick in, right? So, and we should note that the mobilization and the illegal annexation was Putin's response to this dramatic shift in momentum in the war. He knew he had to do something to try to stem Ukraine's advances and regain some initiative in this war. So that's the context. But now the Ukrainians understand that there's a window of time before the effects of the mobilization are seen on the battlefield. And I think over the next, 3 to 6 weeks, we should expect them to make another significant push, both before mobilization sets in and before the winter sets in. So I think that's what they're looking to accomplish. They want to go into winter in as strong of a position as possible so that in spring, they again can continue to reclaim territory.
So you talk about the imperative of the demonstration effect to its Western supporters, the need to achieve certain facts on the ground before winter sets in. How much of the timing of this has also though been driven by more effective weaponry supplied primarily by the United States, but by the West in general? How much has that element tipped the balance or supported this stunning offensive as you characterize it?
I think they're not unrelated. I think, that Zelensky and the Ukrainians were communicating very clearly to the United States that they wanted to do this counteroffensive. And it was, reported in open press that there were even some kind of war gamings and some consultations that were going on to help shape the scope of that Ukrainian counteroffensive. So I think it has all been highly coordinated. We see the United States continuing to provide Ukraine with the weapons that they need at the moment. That's shifted over time dramatically. So I think I think those two things are unrelated, but we certainly know that the HIMARS have made a really tremendous impact, that they've used them extremely effectively, and that has it really contributed to the momentum that we see.
And are you concerned at all that this offensive had been so effective and happened so fast that, in fact, if anything, now the Ukrainians are at risk of being stretched too thin against this very, very long and multi-faced front line?
No. And I say that because I had the opportunity actually to be in Kyiv about 2 weeks ago, just in the immediate aftermath of their success in the north. We got to talk not only to President Zelensky, but also to several military leaders. They were extremely sober-minded. I mean, they could have been riding high and a little bit giddy with the success that they were having, and they were extremely pragmatic and sober-minded and aware of the challenges that they continue to face. They are aware of the risks of being spread too thin. So I think that they know that. I do think that we should expect some of the momentum that we've seen to slow down, perhaps in the next 3 to 6 weeks after a major push, because it is true that Ukrainian forces are also exhausted and tired. That will also be part of the headwinds that they face going into the winter.
And how do you, as you talk about going into the winter now, after this next push that you are talking about, once real winter, real Ukrainian winter sets in, how do you see the dynamic then playing out? Or is it going to, do things slow down, or and everybody sort of sits in their entrenched positions until the thaw, or what?
I actually, that was my question that I put to the J5, and his comment or his response was that they've been fighting Russians since 2014 and they don't stop for winter. But I do think things will slow down a little bit, but it's not, I don't think it'll be, as you described, kind of people hunkering down in trenches. I think it'll continue. It probably just not at the pace that we've seen. I think they're ready to fight through the winter. And yeah. I guess the other thing we should say is if they sense opportunity from that. So for example, the Russian fighters in the south, we know that there's all sorts of problems with the Russian supply lines down there. I don't think those guys have winter gear, for example. The Ukrainians are getting a lot of contributions from the West. And so you can bet that if they sense opportunity to exploit, that they will. So I think it's likely that it'll slow down, but it's not gonna come to a halt by any means.
So Michelle, when you hear and see everything that Andrea was just talking about, you know, how adaptable has the Russian military and its leadership proven or not proven to you? I mean, after the initial failure of that kind of blitzkrieg, try to decapitate Kyiv, failed, and they moved into more of a battlefield configuration that seemed to advantage the Russians, that kind of open field tank warfare kind of condition. Now we're back, as Andrea has just described, Russians are back on the back foot again. But how are they? Are they actually adapting, or are they remaining kind of dogmatic to Russian military doctrine? And I guess the second part of that question then is, when these new weapons platforms, like say the HIMARS, are introduced into the battlefield, which swings things in the Ukrainian direction, does the efficacy of those weapons sort of, you know, deteriorate over time because the Russians adjust to what their capabilities are?
So I think so far the Russian military has really struggled to adapt. They did not expect the level of resistance and the level of capability and proficiency that we've seen from the Ukrainian forces, nor did they anticipate the level of support from the West. From the beginning, they've lacked effective command and control, effective field-grade leadership on the ground among the units. They've struggled with logistics and supply lines, and they really weren't trained and prepared for the kind of warfare they've actually faced on the ground. I think their primary adaptation has been, as Andrea said, Putin's willingness to mobilize additional people. but it doesn't change the fundamental problems that they face as a military. We've also seen, I mean, I think this will ultimately revise some of our estimates of the quality of Russian forces. I don't want to say we thought they were 10 feet tall, but certainly taller than we're seeing that they actually are. And one of the things we've seen is they do not fight as a joint force. And by that, I mean, their air force hasn't been able to coordinate with their ground force to provide effective air cover, for example. That is something that is point of the realm for US forces, for NATO forces. Russians haven't been able to demonstrate they can do that. So they're having trouble adapting, but as they do adapt, it's also raising the political stakes for Putin. This mobilization, now it's sort of Putin is all in politically. You know, he's now, you know, having to mobilize the country or portions of the country. We're seeing the mixed impacts of that. And it's dramatically increased the political stakes for him, for how this all turns out.
Yeah, and I want to dig into that in a minute here. But as you suggest, the Ukrainians have proven to be very highly adaptable. But Andrea, I do have a question for you on this front, though. There's been a lot of talk and a lot of disclosure from the West about what the scale of Russian losses have been, something to the tune of about 80,000 casualties, about 25,000 plus of those deaths, arrests, injuries, and taken off the battlefield. We hear a lot less about what the cost has been to the Ukrainian side, though I imagine it's got to be pretty grim too. Do you have a sense of that?
No, I don't. I mean, and they've been very kind of secretive about that for obvious reasons. And I think, you know, when we talk about kind of intelligence gaps or key questions that we are unanswered, I think that's number one. When I was there, that issue, I mean, and I guess we wouldn't have expected that it would come up, but it's not something that comes up. We continue to hear, right, that Ukraine actually has the manpower advantage. They have mobilized, they are on wartime footing, and their shortcoming at this time is the weapons and the training to get those fighters to the front line. So I don't have a good sense of how kind of degraded the Ukrainian military is. But my sense is that, you know, that is not their shortcoming, and it continues to be the lack of support and weapons and training to get available fighters into the war.
So, Michelle, you know, this brings us to a topic that's been under a lot of discussion of late, so we got to cover it here, and that is the nuclear issue. Now, it seems like a dangerous moment when a leader or a country faces either an existential catastrophic threat, or they have the choice to kind of roll the dice at that point. I don't think we're necessarily there yet, but I think when you start seeing the pushing the Russians out of their so-called annexed territory, things start moving in that kind of a direction. And we're in a situation where it seems like there's an unstable balance of power. I mean, you know, Andrea just described more men, better weapons, better battlefield strategy and skill on the Ukrainian part, better trained, and the Russians have a nuclear arsenal. So I guess my first question to you is, you know, well, on the one hand, in some ways, has the nuclear card been played by Russia, short of use, of course, in the sense that it's essentially been successful to the degree that the West is not an active combatant on the battlefield, and we are not providing weapons to the Ukrainians that can strike deep into Russian territory. So has the non-use play of the Russian card already been done, or is there more effectiveness out of that still?
Well, I think I do think that from the beginning, the US and its NATO allies have been very careful to try to avoid this escalating into an all-out war between NATO and Russia. Not only because of the nuclear implications, but because of the broader implications. So in that sense, the nuclear shadow is already cast over the conflict. But I do think, you know, it could get worse. So Russian doctrine is termed escalate to de-escalate. And Putin is aware of his own military's conventional inferiority compared to the collective forces of NATO. And so doctrine has long been, look, we're going to threaten or even use nuclear weapons early in a conflict so that, you know, it sort of scares everybody, causes them to back off, reevaluate, and gives us some advantage at the negotiating table to dictate terms. I don't think we're there yet, but I think because Putin's fully committed politically now, I think he has to have, you know, he hasn't recognized that his military cannot deliver the outcomes he seeks. But if the Ukrainians push back so hard that he has nothing to show for the February invasion, then he's in trouble. In terms of his actual ability to stay in office and remain the Russian leader. And I think he might have, at that point, have his back against the wall. In that case, I could see him, you know, setting off a demonstration shot. Doesn't necessarily have to be used in Ukraine, but doing something to really shake things up, scare everybody, and come to the negotiating table to dictate terms that are more favorable than his battlefield position would generally support. So that's the scenario I worry about. But he has to consider, I think he would, again, be shooting himself in the foot. I think China would back away from him. India would back away. I mean, the world that has been, you know, maybe not as strong in condemning Russian action to date in Ukraine would distance themselves greatly if he actually used a nuclear weapon. He would secure his place in history as a pariah and very long-term and draconian sanctions against Russia as long as he's in power.
So just so I understand, and we should note that, you know, the Chechen leader Kadyrov, who, I mean, he's a madman, we all know that already anyway, but he's become the first Russian official to sort of openly call for consideration of use of a tactical nuclear weapon. But just so I understand, you're talking about if Putin is pushed back against that wall, are you suggesting that it's a fairly high probability in your estimation? And where do you think you come down on that estimation versus, say, the IC and the White House in terms of that he would actually do it?
I wouldn't say high probability. I think those are the conditions under which I think he would consider it. The other option for him is to, you know, try to put lipstick on the pig, you know, accept some negotiated outcome and live to fight another day. You know, pull out and or not pull out completely, but, you know, sort of consolidate his position, back off, and then prepare for to fight Ukraine another day. Or a third option, and this, I think this is probably highest probability, worries me most, is just be a spoiler. Keep lobbing long-range missiles against Ukrainian cities. Prevent Ukraine from returning to normalcy, from rebuilding, from reconstruction, from being able to get on with, you know, putting themselves back together. Just keep using gray zone tactics and long range missiles to just keep hammering them. That is something I could see him doing more, and I'd give that higher probability than the use of a nuclear weapon. But I don't think it's impossible that we could see him be so crazy and so not crazy, but just, you know, miscalculating and make a huge mistake of actually using a nuclear weapon.
And just so our audience understands, because the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, I believe the Secretary of State may have also said this over the last weekend on the Sunday shows and the like, that if Russia were to employ a nuclear weapon, that there would be a quote-unquote catastrophic response. How would, and I know it's somewhat cryptic, I know you're on the inside of a lot of these discussions, or you were,
not now, but I
without giving away too. I mean, how should people interpret what catastrophic means? What is in the sort of quiver of options here in that instance? Because, you know, the former president of Russia, Medvedev, a Putin lackey, essentially, you know, kind of suggested the United States didn't have the stomach and that the escalate to de-escalate strategy would essentially be effective. What should we be thinking about what the U.S. response optionality is here?
I think crossing that nuclear threshold would put new options on the table that the US and NATO have not considered before. I think that, and I think I'm pretty sure that those options are being developed for the president right now, and they would range, they would span the full range. My own personal assessment is that the US would not need to and would be unlikely to use a nuclear weapon in response. You know, two wrongs don't make a right. But I think it would certainly likely remove some of the constraints on our conventional support for Ukraine in terms of enabling them to have a very substantial military response. But I think also, again, a lot of the catastrophic aspects of this response would be in terms of the degree of political isolation, economic sanction, international condemnation, in addition to ensuring that Russia would not win this war on the battlefield.
And are you comfortable that that message is, in perhaps even more explicitly, being delivered both at the highest level, meaning to Putin himself, so that there's no ambiguity, but also that, say, you know, the intelligence community is communicating to those levels down that would actually have to execute policy, don't do this?
Yeah, I don't know what, I don't have any inside knowledge on this particular question, but my guess is that the message to Putin is being stated very clearly, not in terms of exactly what we would do, but in terms of the, you know, our resolve and the force of our response, the strength of our response. But I also think that some of the most effective voices right now will be hearing from other countries about how they, you know, China, how would China react to this? How would India react to this? How would much of the global South that has not taken sides in this conflict, how would they respond? I think Putin needs to be made aware of where nuclear use will leave him and will leave Russia, and that will be in a much more difficult situation than they're already in.
And how do you think China and India would respond? I mean, would that pariah status be affected?
Well, absolutely. I think they would want to distance themselves from Russia as much as possible, and it would change the relationship with both of them.
So, Andrea, what is your impression now of what is going on inside of Russia and the Putin regime specifically? I mean, with the full annexation announcements that they made last weekend, which no other country has recognized, obviously, but the narrative has, you know, continued to evolve, right, in terms of what's being sold to the world and to the Russian people. Now it is about protecting territory and framing the war as an existential battle with the West, which, you know, he now has explicitly referred to as the enemy, and he's referred to the Satanism of the United States. So this is no longer just about denazifying Ukraine and its Jewish president. So what do you see going on inside of the Putin regime right now?
Yeah, I think that's an important point that you made, though. I mean, the narrative inside Russia is that it's not just Ukraine. I mean, Putin really has framed this kind of in civilizational terms. And, you know, he, in that speech that he gave, kind of laid it out in those terms. So, yes, it's about Ukraine. But I think Putin really sees this as the moment to kind of go after the U.S., try to rewrite the rules and the world order in a way that's more to Russia's liking. I think part of the annexation, too, not just the deterrent effect and the extension of the nuclear umbrella, but I think it was also to try to change the narrative inside Russia that this is a defensive war. So there are probably many Russians wouldn't be on board with this offensive war. But now that they're trying very hard to convince Russians that it is defensive, and maybe that makes something like the use of a nuclear weapon at some point more palatable to Russians also. But I have said from the beginning of the war, I think that Putin is on shakier ground now than he was before. And I think that is even more the case after the mobilization and the illegal annexation. I mean, that was a move for 7 months Putin has avoided having to do this mobilization because he understood very well that it was politically risky. And we're seeing that play out now. I mean, the execution of this mobilization is chaotic, it's ineffective. Local, regional officials have been implementing it in all sorts of different ways. They have different quota that they have to meet. I mean, it really, you can see the images. And I think that's, for me, is the key. Because even though Russia hasn't been doing well in Ukraine, the state media, that's far away and Russians can't see it. And the state media can frame the way that they understand that war. But with something that's happening on Russian soil, Russians can see it with their own eyes. And there's very little that the Kremlin can do to control that narrative. So I feel like it's almost like the emperor has no clothes moment. Like, these are things that expose the incompetence of a regime and can really change the way that the public views the capacity. So I think at a public level, this has been very damaging to Putin. And in large part because, as we said, he's been trying to portray this sense of normalcy for a very long time. Before mobilization, there was interesting polling that showed that Russians were paying ever less attention to the war. I mean, people were willing to write it off and move on with their lives. And obviously, this has entirely upended that. So I think it has created these fertile conditions that make him more vulnerable. And I think we're also seeing more signs of infighting within the elite. There's very clearly something playing out between Prigozhin and Kadyrov on the one hand and Shoigu on the other. So, with my understanding of authoritarian regimes, when these elite divisions play out in public, they're always there, right? There's always elite infighting, but it usually is behind the scenes. But when these things spill over into the public domain, it's when people understand that there are cracks in the regime. And that shapes people's willingness over time, I think, to take on the regime and challenge it. So again, I don't think it's not imminent. Certainly, I don't think that. But I keep, you know, there is this sense that his hold on power is even more tenuous now than even since he went into Ukraine.
So let's unpack that just a little bit. Starting first with the mobilization and what the Russian people are, how they're responding. So clearly, in the initial days and hours of the war, you had this kind of exodus of highly educated, professional, sort of city-dwelling Russians who tried to get out and went to Europe, and then things sort of settled down. And as you say, there was ever less attention being paid to the war, which was far off. Then the mobilization is announced, and strikingly, more Russian men have actually left Russia in the last week than have actually successfully been conscripted into the army, my understanding. And, you know, it seems to sort of betray this notion there's a difference between sort of armchair patriotism and actual willingness to go and fight for something. But if, as this narrative has shifted, are you suggesting that the Russian people then are not buying that narrative? Is with as much control as he's got, as Putin and his regime has got over media, particularly television, that it's not successfully resonating? Or are we biased in what we're, you know, in terms of the data points that we're taking to suggest what that support level might be?
Well, that's always hard with closed authoritarian regimes, right? I think that's always the challenge. Anticipating the timing that an authoritarian regime will collapse is nearly impossible. And even coming from the intelligence community, we can warn that conditions are ripe, but identifying the moment at which it happens is really impossible, right? We didn't do it with the Arab Spring, and I don't think we're going to be able to predict precisely if Putin's regime were to collapse the precise moment that it would happen. So it's really hard to say. It's hard to understand how to interpret some of the anecdotal evidence. It's obviously very difficult to interpret various polling data that's coming out. But what we do see since mobilization, Putin's support was riding fairly high even since the invasion in Ukraine. His public support had shot back up similar to the Crimea levels, where this type of action again did generate a rally around the flag and people were supportive of Putin. Since mobilization, the support for Putin has fallen, and also polling showing extremely high anxiety numbers, fewer Russians feeling like Russia's moving in the right direction. Again, it's really hard to know how to interpret that, but I guess the way I always think of it is that underlying fodder is getting ever more brittle and dry, such that it will take a smaller spark to catalyze something in motion. It will take something to come in and catalyze, whether it's elite-led or getting some kind of focal point that's going to actually get people out on the streets. But I think the conditions are ripe for something like that.
At this point, though, are you seeing a bias in terms of the mobilization that they are attempting to, that there's a an over mobilization, if you will, of ethnic minorities rather than ethnic Russians to try to again mitigate the impact on the on the Russian sort of assessment of Putin?
Yeah, that's absolutely happening. A continued effort to try to protect, you know, quote unquote, politically important Russians. That's still happening. And you do see some low level protests out in the regions. Those at this point aren't consequential. But again, it's that, but you do hear anecdotes from people inside Moscow and St. Petersburg in the cities who were very happy not to pay attention to this war, but who are sending loved ones away. Kevin, you mentioned Russians have left. I saw Forbes Russia reported 700,000 Russians have left. I'm not sure if that's the right number, but that's what's being reported. So this is touching everyone. And I guess I come back to that. People are seeing with their own eyes the images of incompetence. And if you're deciding over time if you want to take on an authoritarian regime, and its incompetence is being exposed, or you expect that there's divisions in the elite that might change how they respond to mass numbers out on the streets, that shapes people's calculus. And so if there is some sort of kind of exogenous arc that can mobilize, I think it changes people's calculus about their willingness to challenge the regime. Again, I don't want to oversell it. I don't think it's imminent. We know that Putin has plenty of tools. The security services do remain loyal. But to your point about controlling the narrative, some of the anxiety and displeasure with Russia's performance in Ukraine is creeping in to the talk shows. And you can see people talking about failures around Kherson and other places. So I think it is getting harder for the Kremlin to control the narrative.
And is the plan, to the best of your knowledge, I mean, are they going, during this mass mobilization, are they going to take advantage of the sort of military slowdown of winter and train these troops up so they have a more effective fighting force come spring? Or are they sending these guys straight to the front as effectively cannon fodder, if you will?
At the moment, we're hearing a lot of these guys are getting about 1 week of training. A lot of their weapons don't even work or function. And the problem is, I think my understanding, and Michelle, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the way the Russians train their soldiers is by unit. So they don't, I don't think, have this kind of basic training where people would go and get training. They do a lot of the training in their units. And then the problem is with your, if those units are already degraded, including at mid and senior levels. And so actually being able to train up new soldiers to fight is extremely problematic. So I don't think that they're gonna get the training that they need. And certainly the evidence that we've seen so far just underscores this idea that really it's about a week of training and then they're being thrown out there.
One last question on the Russia front before I move to the US. There was a lot of talk in recent weeks that, and we've seen this in other wars in the past as well, that Putin himself was taking, you know, from his remote bunker, he was taking more tactical, you know, responsibility for what was going on the battlefield in Ukraine, and, you know, forcing commanders on the ground to not fall back when they were, you know, when they were under assault and so on and so forth. Do you get this sense that there's this kind of this control has been taken back, and that, you know, they're obviously have been operating since day one or before day one with imperfect intelligence and information from what was going on the ground? Is that continuing in your estimation?
So I think at the intelligence level that, I mean, they, as Michelle noted, a lot of these kind of structural underlying problems, intelligence has been one. And when I was in Ukraine talking to some of the military officials there, I think they've really been flabbergasted by just how bad Russia has been on the intelligence front, that a lot of it is just sticking guys out on the front lines and reporting back. And so that I don't think has improved. The other thing the Ukrainians noted, and Michelle alluded to this, is in part with bad intelligence, the Ukrainians have been really shocked by how incapable the Russians are at taking advantage of situations. So the Ukrainians themselves have seen advantages that the Russians could have exploited, but because of either poor intelligence or the culture that Michelle was talking about, not trusting subordinates, they have to run everything up the chain of command, they just can't do it. So all of those problems still exist. And on top of that, my sense is that Putin still is doing this in a still very hands-on way. Some of the things, you know, I've heard from other military analysts, the continued offensives around Donetsk and some of these other places that the Russians continue to do kind of don't make sense, I think, from a big strategic standpoint. But they seem to be things that Putin personally is interested in. So I think he is still very involved. And then certainly there's the kind of constant firing of generals who he perceives as underperforming. And that is really bad for morale, obviously, at senior levels as well. So, I mean, he's meddling in all sorts of ways that I think have been unproductive.
So, Michelle, I want to turn to the United States now, and I've got a number of questions for you on this front, but maybe we can frame it by what you think the U.S.'s objective is now, in the sense that is it to prevent Ukraine from losing, or is it to actually win? I don't know how you would define exactly a victory here, but what do you think the primary objective is?
I think the primary objective, as it's been stated, has been to support Ukraine in defending its sovereignty and, you know, its territory and preventing any kind of ultimate success for the Russian aggression. But I don't think the U.S. has articulated a set of war aims separate from supporting Ukraine and ensuring that Russia is not successful at this point.
Talk a little bit about, at the beginning, at the top of the call, we talked a little bit about, you know, the effectiveness of the weaponry that has been provided to Ukraine, sort of the, you know, early in the early days, it was the anti-tank weaponry. But of late, you know, the sort of the iconic weapon of the war has now become the HIMARS system, as an example. But, you know, it always begs the question, why are we providing those now? Why did we not provide those early on in the war to try to you know, turn the tide earlier? Why do we only send the numbers that we do? Why do we not send more? Can you walk us through the process of how the government, both at the White House and at the Defense Department, makes these decisions about what type of weaponry to supply, when to do it, and how much to do?
So these decisions are being conducted as in an interagency process that is chaired by the National Security Council advisor. It's sort of the first iteration is at the deputies level, and where people are looking at the different options, the pros and cons, and then recommendations go up to the principals level and ultimately to the president. The key thing that the U.S. has been trying to balance all along has been, on the one hand, supporting Ukrainian effectiveness as much as possible, mindful of how much, you know, their absorptive capacity, you know, how much can they absorb, how much time and training will it take, you know, are the supply chains feasible, are our own stockpiles viable, because in some of these cases we're getting towards the bottom of the barrel in terms of our own stockpiles without necessarily an industrial base that's able to restart production lines in certain categories. But the primary factor has been, how do we support the Ukrainians without enabling escalation that would widen the war to a NATO-Russia? And so walking that line has been the name of the game. And as the battle on the ground has changed, the needs have changed. You know, what they needed initially is different than what they need now and will be different than what they need going forward. And so now in this phase of the war where we see the Ukrainians having successful counteroffensive, now issues are being revisited. Should we provide more longer range HIMARS? Should we provide armored vehicles? Should we provide other types of systems? And so those debates are active. And you also see from the Ukrainian side, it's been reported some creative suggestions from them, like, well, maybe US can have targeting oversight. So you could give us the longer range systems, but the US would have a say in how we use them so that we don't inadvertently escalate the war with Russia. So I think all of that's being worked through, but it's really trying to balance how do you support Ukrainian success and momentum, but also how do you prevent the kind of escalation that would widen and worsen the war.
And is it fair to say that even though other countries have have promised weaponry and other supplies of materiel to Ukraine, that really everybody takes their lead from the U.S. I mean, it occurs to me that there's been a lot of press around conversations going on between the Ukrainians and the Germans, for instance, over the supply of tanks. And, Germany has been resistant to that thus far. And the question that they seem to ask the Ukrainians is, well, is anybody else supplying tanks to you? And I think the real question there is the United States about to? So, is that fair to say that basically everybody is taking their cue from what the U.S. will do, both in terms of military support, financial support, political support?
Yeah, I think the administration's done a really effective job setting up a NATO coordination mechanism and these regular summits, if you will, or meetings at the Secretary of Defense, Minister of Defense level for all of the NATO countries to coordinate and collaborate on who's contributing what to make sure Ukraine's getting what they need, but that we're being consistent, in what we provide. So I think that mechanism is working very well. It is chaired by the U.S. and the NATO commander. Or the NATO Secretary General. But I do think that there is a new sense of pressure on the U.S. and NATO to do more, to provide more, so that Ukraine can exploit this moment of opportunity and push forward with some of these counteroffensives and be more effective. So I do think that's important. I just want to add one thing, that we didn't start from a standing start with Ukraine, and this is often lost. After Crimea, where Russia kind of waltzed into Crimea, not a shot was fired, the Ukrainians couldn't do much of anything to resist. We spent the years between 2014 and 2022 training, advising, assisting, building the capability of the Ukrainian forces, particularly their special operations forces. So when you saw the force be very much more effective this time around, whether it's, particularly in asymmetric strategies and sabotage and undermining, taking advantage of Russian vulnerabilities, that is based on, a concerted NATO effort, mostly individual countries within NATO as vice NATO itself, but serious training, advising, and assisting for a number of years that really took the Ukrainian military from one point to where it is now, with the capacity to absorb all of this and to adjust its operational planning and have this kind of success versus a larger, better equipped force.
I want to ask you though, Michelle, before the invasion occurred, you and I had discussions and I heard you speaking with clients and others. The intelligence community got it right with regards to the intent of the Russians, and you admonished people to listen to what they were saying. This is going to happen. Even though I think there was resistance to some degree in markets and even in some corporations that like, this just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make economic sense for Russia. Why would they do such a thing? You reminded people I think we chronically underestimate the willingness of political actors to take actions against their economic self-interest. But I wonder if we were as good in terms of our intelligence assessments, if we were as good about what Russian capabilities and competence were. And in retrospect, if the intelligence community was wrong about that, why do you think we were wrong about that? And that does that cause us to reassess how we're thinking about capabilities of other countries? And of course, top of my mind here is China.
Yeah. So I think in terms of our assessment of Russian military, You know, we were certainly looking at the order of battle, which is the number of units, the how they're equipped, et cetera. And we were kind of giving them credit for past performance. They have had at least an elite set of units that have demonstrated capability before, both in exercises and in operations. And so what was difficult to assess is what we couldn't see. So the degree to which their training of personnel and cultivation of leadership at the field grade level had deteriorated. The extent to which their logistics system had just broken down, and we still don't know whether that is simply failure to adapt to a new way of warfare or corruption that bled money out of that system. So, you know, supplies that were listed, you know, as being on the books didn't actually exist and never got to units. And so I think we overestimated them. And I think there is a lesson there, but you can also overlearn it. So, I mean, in the case of China, and particularly their capacity to mount some sort of aggression against Taiwan in the coming years, they will look very daunting in terms of numbers of forces on a table. But they are not combat tested. The logistics challenges of getting across 200 kilometers of water and sustaining an operation are not small. They lack the ability to delegate authority that enables forces to adapt to situations as they evolve. We don't know how robust their command and control system is, how brittle it will be when it's subject to cyber and electronic attack and all of the other things that they would actually experience in combat. So there are a lot of questions there. And I think from my perspective, the important thing is that we exploit those uncertainties to deter Xi, so that, you know, he's got to be looking at what's happened to the Russian military in Ukraine and wondering, is my military really as good as they tell me they are? You know, what are they not telling me? How do I really know? And to the extent we can just demonstrate the fragility, the vulnerability, or capabilities that we have that he doesn't know we have, you know, that sort of reveal them at the right moment, just to make him step back and say, oh, I'm not so sure about this, maybe not today. That is the essence of deterrence, or one element of deterrence, along with showing political resolve and building a coalition that would be very clearly against any kind of China's aggression and many other things. But that is a key portion of this. We have to exploit the doubt that this Russian experience undoubtedly has put into Xi's mind.
I hear what you're saying. Do you think, from what you understand about the structure of the Chinese military and the government's control over it? Obviously, President Xi holds not only the top, you know, the presidency and the head of the Communist Party, but he's also the head of the military commission as well. They presumably recognize some of exactly what you've been talking about as well. And do you get the sense that there is a real learning process on the Chinese front that is causing them to ask exactly those questions to, you know, take the opposite side, which is to eliminate, in their mind at least, as much of that doubt that you're talking about trying to exploit and raise at the same time?
Yeah, it's been pretty well reported that the Chinese leadership is aiming to learn lessons from this. Number one, they're studying what went wrong for the Russian military and porting those lessons over. Number two, they're asking the question, what if the Taiwanese resist? I mean, that has never been part of their assumptions. That's never been assumed in their planning, and watching what's happened in Ukraine that has given them pause. And number three, if we were to become the subject of substantial sanctions, how would we deal with that? What are the levers that we could pull in terms of the Western dependency on our supply chains to try to avoid those sanctions being put into place? They are studying all of that. But fundamentally, she is vulnerable to some of the kinds of miscalculation that Putin is because of the nature of the system. He is on top of an authoritarian system that does not incentivize people speaking truth to power, that does not incentivize reporting bad news, questioning faulty assumption, you know, questioning plans that might not work. He's created an environment where he's going to get a lot of yes sir and a lot of saluting, even if people are doubting the viability of what's being proposed. And that is always a fundamental vulnerability for an authoritarian leader like you.
So, two last questions for you. The first is, has there been any really genuine surprise to you in this? I mean, it sounds like, you know, there's some surprise in terms of the incompetence of the Russian performance here. But once that became clear, then things like ultimately having to mobilize, having to change the narrative, all of that was kind of predictable. But in terms of say the unity of the West in this, and keeping various allies on message and on mark, or you know, yesterday OPEC Plus acted in a way that probably made a lot of sense from their perspective, but clearly didn't help from the U.S.'s perspective. You know, and other say lesser aligned countries and their reaction to this. Have there been any major surprises from your perspective?
I think I was surprised by the degree to which Putin miscalculated in everything from his assessment of how NATO would respond to his assessment of how the Ukrainians respond to the performance of his own military to how the world was responding. I mean, he got it wrong on every major dimension. The degree to which he got it wrong has surprised me. I have been pleasantly surprised by the rapidity and the degree to which NATO has come together as a cohesive unit. I mean, to have the Germans stand up on day one the way they did, I expected just because of the way they do decision making internally that would have taken at least some more time and eventually they would have gotten to the right place. But the political courage and cohesion of NATO has really been a pleasant surprise, but it's come together better than I thought. Yeah, I think those have been the principal surprises. I do think that, again, you know, the implications are pretty far reaching in that we will never go back to where we were with Russia, and Europe will never go back to where it was. So lots of trends are being accelerated that I think will be playing out for a number of years. And we're still trying to get our hands around what all that will actually mean.
Yeah, you know, Fiona Hill has become a household name, obviously, because of her testimony during the Trump administration and so on. But she's pretty blunt when it comes to her assessments of Russia. And she and Angela Stent have a piece in the latest Foreign Affairs, which sort of, I think, is preparing us exactly for what you're talking about, essentially saying, you know, that any concerns that Putin may have had about long-term economic impact from the war have receded from his view, and that he seems uninterested in a compromise that would leave Ukraine as a sovereign and independent state, whatever its borders might be. And so I guess my final question to you is, and you talked about, we're not going back to the way things were, and then you're talking to a certain degree on a state-on-state level, you know, U.S. relations with Russia. But, you know, in our business, we're talking a lot to multinational corporations, many of whom had a presence in Russia. I think for many outside of the hydrocarbon space, that wasn't a particularly significant portion of their business, certainly versus the exposure that they've got to, say, China in many ways. But But where do you think we're ultimately going with Russia in terms of an environment for people to do business? As long as the Putin regime or somebody likes him remains in place, is that going to be essentially a no-go zone? Or do you think that that some sort of new, you know, modus operandi, modus vivendi may emerge for dealing with Russia over time?
I think as long as Putin is in power and as long as someone who's implementing similar policies is in power, Russia is going to be treated as a pariah, and it will be a no-go zone in terms of export controls, investment, sanctions, etc. I think unless you had a fundamental change of behavior, that is a truth. But I also think, you know, the energy transition that I would argue is belated in Europe, I think that is now going to accelerate, and that is going to have all kinds of interesting implications, including a number of opportunities for business going forward. And I do think this is going to affect the politics in Europe for a while. And I do think there in some countries where there's been a very difficult economic impact from the war, you're going to see the far right parties get more traction, and there'll be some change in complexion in governments. And we've just seen this in Italy. We're likely to see it in some other places as well. And we'll see how we get through a cold, dark winter. You know, I'm betting on continued cohesion, particularly as long as Ukraine is making progress. But I think, you know, that is going to take a lot of work to keep us on the same page as the pain of this war gets worse for everybody.
Well, you have just given me a perfect advertisement for upcoming episodes of this show over the next several months. We will certainly be talking about energy transition. We will certainly talk about U.S.-China relations, European politics, and of course, the ongoing evolution of this war. So I hope that both you and Andrea will come back because we've covered a lot of ground, and I think you've clarified a lot of things for our audience. I do want to tell people, ask you to please join us again next week, October the 13th. We will be doing our preview of the upcoming U.S. midterm elections. My guest will be the former Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. Paul Ryan will be with me. But until then, I want to thank Michelle Flournoy and Andrea Kendall-Taylor. She had to drop off. But Michelle, thanks very much. This has been great. Really appreciate your insights today. And thank you, everybody, for joining us.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kajiwara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.